Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with my co-host John Wells. Today we'll speak first with Jared Heyman. He's the CEO of a fascinating medical technology company called CrowdMed. Imagine you have a rare disease, you've been to doctors all over the country, no one has come up with a diagnosis. This is the tool that has proven to diagnose, and it involves crowdsourcing. Very interesting.
It is interesting. And good morning.
Good morning, John.
Our second guest is Lynn Scher. She's a biographer who's written a book about her friend and the first woman in space, Sally Ride. We'll talk about the male-dominated space program, the profile and personality of a woman in space, and how it was in the 80s for the only woman in the graduate physics department at Stanford. Stay tuned.
All that plus today's cool story about another woman who pioneered in her field. It's the woman who invented Kevlar. Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and this green earth. Rocky Mountain Power Watt Smart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, WattSmart.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with my co-host John Wells. Jared Heyman is a serial tech entrepreneur, but he's embarked on a new venture that's taken shape as it's one of a kind. It's called CrowdMed. It's recently made news as actor Patrick Dempsey, who plays a doctor on Grey's Anatomy, of course, provided some of the seed money along with some other highly reputed venture capital firms. And the idea goes like this. You have a rare illness. Experts haven't been able to figure it out. So you go to the masses of medical detectives in this online diagnosing system. It enlists crowdsourcing, and it's accurate, often much faster to diagnose. And, well, how do they use statistical algorithms to establish validity in diagnosing medical conditions? Well, joining us now is CEO Jared Heyman. Jared, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Okay. Thank you. Good to be here.
All right, good to have you. Well, first of all, take us through what CrowdMed does. So I am ill. I have not been diagnosed. I can go online and fill out a questionnaire. Take us from there.
Sure. So as a patient, the first step is to fill out our patient questionnaire, as you mentioned. We ask a bunch of questions around your symptoms you're experiencing, your medical history, family medical history, demographic, lifestyle, basically all the clues that our medical detective community might need to try to solve your case. And once your case is submitted, then you need to submit a $50 refundable deposit. That deposit is refunded at the end of the process, but we keep that money to assure that you stay engaged throughout the process. And at the end, tell us what were the best diagnostic or solution suggestions you received, since we need that information to reward our medical detective community. Optionally, you can also offer a cash compensation offer to our medical detectives, and that helps attract our best and brightest medical detectives to your case. So if you do offer a cash compensation, the minimum is $200. We've seen offers as high as $1,000, and that only goes to the medical detectives who do the best job solving your case on the site.
So the medical detectives are, I assume, sort of rated just like you would rate a hotel, for example, online, 1 to 4 stars. Is that how they establish their credibility as a medical detective? I suppose they call that social media accountability.
That's correct. So we have what we call our detective rating system. And the detective ratings go from a DR1 all the way to a DR10. And when a detective starts off, they have a low detective rating. But then over time, they can build it up by doing a good job performing on the site. We measure that performance in terms of how many correct diagnoses or solutions they suggest, how many points they win, and also their peer ratings. So the detectives can rate each other on a 5-point scale, and we get an average peer rating by looking at that, which also factors in heavily into the detective rating. And then as detectives have higher rating, not only can you see that rating, so you know who are our best detectives as they interact with you on the chat or discussion features, but also they have more influence. So as one's detective rating grows, so does their influence on the site and their ability to actually influence the patient's results.
And Jared, this is an extraordinarily powerful tool. When you think about crowdsourcing, it's the wisdom of the crowd will always be more intelligent than a single expert. So in your field, there are 13,000 known diseases. There's a whole bunch of diseases that aren't known. And what you're doing is going out to unidentified to this crowd, and it's the wisdom of this crowd that is able to move things forward. Is that correct?
That's right, John. You summed it up perfectly. We believe strongly that that crowds of individuals are much smarter than even the smartest individual experts in the world. And we think it's a shame that our medical system is really revolves around individual experts that we call doctors working in isolation. Because if we can get dozens or even sometimes 100 or more medical experts collaborating on a variety of expertise and biases, we can give much more intelligent diagnostic solution suggestions to a patient than even the smartest individual doctor could produce.
And this is not the first time this has been going on for many, many years, but as far as on the internet, the French government actually put together a prize for looking for new ways to invent food preservation products. And the British government came up with a sort of a crowdsourcing project called the Longitude Prize during the Great Depression, or actually that was the other one, this Mathematical Tables Project. So there are a number of situations where this has happened in the past, and it's just extraordinarily powerful now that it's on the internet.
Exactly. You know, we didn't invent the idea of crowdsourcing or crowd wisdom. I think human beings have known for a long time that that we are much smarter collectively than we are individually. And we've seen crowdsourcing and crowd wisdom harnessed to produce insights and intelligent results in a variety of industries. And we're just the first ones to bring this to the medical industry using the power of the internet.
I can only imagine the AMA's reaction to this, but I'll ask you anyway, what is their reaction?
Well, we haven't heard anything from them yet, at least not as an organization, although I have heard from many doctors and other medical practitioners about CrowdMed. And, we see a range of reactions from the medical community. Often, initially, the doctors view anything that comes off the internet with a certain degree of suspicion. Mm-hmm. I think doctors have become accustomed to patients just going to sites like, Google or WebMD or Wikipedia and just randomly printing out a bunch of things that may not be relevant to their case. And then the doctor has to spend a lot of time explaining to the patient why this isn't correct. But once the medical community and the practitioners realize that CrowdMed is something different, we're not just another online medical content site, but we're rather a tool for aggregating the collective wisdom of medical experts. Real human beings with different expertise collaborating to solve a tough case. And the results we produce are something fundamentally different than what a patient might get from just online self-diagnosis. I think that medical recognizes that the crowds can be smarter than experts. The only thing, the least bit controversial, is that we do allow non-physicians to participate on our site. And that is somewhat controversial within the medical community. We have strong reasons for doing that.
And that was going to be my next question. You talk about the collective wisdom of experts. Some of them, how do you qualify a quote-unquote expert?
Well, we do define it more broadly than I would say the AMA would. So the traditional medical system would define a medical expert as a certified medical doctor. Someone who's been through med school, they've been through a residency and they've received the endorsement of the medical community by gaining that experience, and that's what gives them credibility. On CrowdMed, we do have the detective rating system, as I mentioned, which is how we measure credibility. But we don't measure credibility based on how many years someone went to med school or whether they got board certified. Mm-hmm. We measure expertise or credibility based upon actual performance. So the people on our site who have the most influence, it's based upon their performance and not their credentials. And that is a departure from how it's done in the traditional medical system.
Oh, it's a pretty huge departure. So it's the rating they receive, it's not a historical performance. It is the rating they receive once they have joined your site, for example.
Well, exactly. So everyone joins at the same status, whether you've been practicing medicine for 40 years or whether you're a med student or whether you're a nutritionist or a mm-hmm. nurse. No matter who you are, you join our site with the exact same level of influence, and you can only increase that influence or credibility rating by performing. So we kind of have this even playing field, and it's not based on our formal credentials, but rather actual performance or prowess when it comes to solving tough medical cases.
It's very interesting, Jared. There's this whole world of you know, lay people, as you're talking about, but they could include anything, like you say, nutritionists or homeopathists or people that have studied, you know, more natural forms of medicine. And well, then there's this whole other world that may be defined as, you know, the world of quackery. Is there a way to suss out that, or do you just accept everything and then you go on their rating as they establish credibility or not?
Lynn, it's a great question. And because we do start with such a broad base of medical detectives, I mean, we let pretty much anyone register for the site. You don't have to just to sign up. It's a very low bar. The question is, how do we filter out the quacks? You know, how do we separate the signal in our community from the noise? And that is, I'd say, that the core of what our technology does. At its core, we are a noise and signal separation machine, where we try to quiet the noise while amplifying the signal, and we do that through reporting back to patients not anecdotal suggestions or results, but rather consensus. So even though one quack might make a off-the-wall diagnostic or solution suggestion, that won't climb to the top of the patient's result unless other medical detectives kind of rally behind it and support it. Huh. So we don't rely on anecdotes, we rely on statistics. And that's one of the core things we do to separate signal and noise. There's other things as well, but that's the heart of it.
I don't know the dynamics or the all the different types of people that are submitting their cases, but I would have to believe that many of those people are a little on the desperate side. They've gone to traditional medicine. It hasn't been able to help them. And for an example, on your main website is a young lady, Sarah Sheridan, 24 years old, who said that she had 3 years of struggling for a diagnosis before she was able to go to CrowdMed. And I'm wondering if these people are desperate. Are they really reaching? And maybe there's not a quack out there, but maybe there's someone that's just throwing around all sorts of ideas, and they, in fact, prolong their suffering because they're trying all these different things?
Well, it goes back to Lynn's question about how we quiet the quacks while assuring that only the most sound, intelligent suggestions make it to our patient. So even though individuals could be flawed, and one medical detective, either intentionally or unintentionally, gives a suggestion that's just really not good for that patient, we find the crowds as a whole are pretty wise. And it's not likely that dozens of medical detectives would independently support the same suggestion if it's not good. So our top, even though we might have 30 different diagnoses suggested for a given patient, and many of those are off, usually the top two or three or four are very sound, very rational, and very well supported. So, you know, if there was a bad actor in there trying to take advantage of a patient's vulnerability, that our system would treat that as noise and wouldn't give it much much rating or much probability when we report our results to the patient.
Right. We did a show on Cool Science Radio about a year ago on big data, and one of the stories that we talked about was during the bird flu, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta had all of these mainframes that were trying to understand where the next outbreak was going to be and those sorts of things. And Google, because they have petabytes of searches every day, took a look at a bunch of searches over a three-month period, and they looked at a lot of data, and they were able to, based on some big data algorithms, get back to the CDC and say, this is where we think your next outbreak will be, and this will be the severity, and just based on people that were doing searches on looking for symptoms and those sorts of things. Do you utilize big data in augmenting your diagnosis?
It's another great question, and we view big data as an alternative way of trying to accomplish the same thing that we accomplish with crowds. So all of the intelligence in our system comes from the heads of our medical detectives. The medical detectives can use whatever resources they care to. They can tap into big data. They can tap into their own personal experience or insights. You know, they can use whatever tools are at their disposal. But all of the intelligence and all of our results is strictly a function of the diagnostic and solution suggestions made by our medical detective community, and then also their point betting behavior. So we use this point betting system as a way of aggregating their collective intelligence and measuring the best supported suggestions. But no, our system doesn't directly incorporate big data at all.
This is such a fascinating conversation. We're speaking with Jared Heyman, the CEO of CrowdMed. Jared, want to ask you about, it's so funny, I feel like I'm in the same conversation I was when someone explained the site, the app Uber or Lyft, where people can get an online taxi, and how those sites are managed in terms of it's the same sort of rating system and statistics that you use to determine who are the best. But it's all fascinating, and I think it comes back to this question of tech, technology, and what's going on. Especially, you're located in the Silicon Valley, right?
San Francisco.
Yes, we're in San Francisco. Oh. Right, which is the valley's kind of moved north, so
right.
They were kind of in the heart of it.
Right, okay. And you have some background in being a repeat tech entrepreneur. So have you been in med tech before?
No, this is my first time in med tech, although I've been an entrepreneur for 15 years, and I have quite a bit of experience when it comes to different methods of harnessing crowd wisdom. But I'm really applying everything I learned about harnessing crowd wisdom and market research and statistics and prediction markets. I'm applying that to healthcare.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that, you know, I think with a lot of industries, we see that the best innovations often come from entrepreneurs who have backgrounds outside of that industry.
Right.
Because we tend to bring in a fresh perspective and a different way of looking at things. So it's probably no coincidence that, us having a very innovative approach and a different way of looking at this comes from a team that that doesn't really have a medical background.
Right, and that's exactly why I bring up the example of Uber or Lyft, that it's the application of technology in this innovative way that comes up with a solution we've never before imagined, you know, maybe in the medical world. So it's really quite fascinating. I wanted to ask you also, you have background in technology, but you have a personal story that goes along with this. Your sister, I believe it was quite hard to diagnose her. So talk about kind of the formation of this concept for you personally.
Sure. Well, the inspiration for CrowdMed was my little sister, who spent 3 years with a really difficult, chronic, undiagnosed medical condition. And over that period, she saw almost 24 different doctors. She racked up six-figure medical bills. And it took 3 years for her, from when she first experienced symptoms to when she finally had a correct diagnosis and treatment plan. And frankly, we were fortunate that she survived that three-year period, because there were times in there where we weren't sure if she would. And I saw her struggle as she just bounced from doctor to doctor, mm-hmm. and the desperation she felt, where these individual physicians, all with very good intentions, were just unable to get to the root cause of her illness. And they weren't really communicating with each other. They were kind of each seeing her illness through their own highly specialized lens. You know, there's that expression, to her hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that certainly applies to medical specialists. And I just saw how broken the system was. And meanwhile, I had been learning about the wisdom of crowds and how large groups of people can be much smarter than individual experts. And I just thought it was really silly when we're dealing with something as important as people's health, that our system still relies entirely on individual experts when crowds are just so much better suited for this. And because I happen to know a lot about crowd wisdom and ways to harness it, I felt that I was in a unique position to kind of combine my knowledge of technology and of collective intelligence, along with the inspiration I had for solving this particular problem due to my sister's experience. That's what led to CrowdMed.
Great story.
So, Jared, you put some money of your own in. You received some seed financing. You have people like Greylock Partners, which are, you know, certainly top tier in the venture capital community. What's the play here? Is it going public? Is it an acquisition? Well, what would you like to see happen?
I mean, we are backed by some of the top venture capital firms in Silicon Valley, which we're flattered by. And it's great to see the support from so many smart investors out here and to have such powerful friends behind us. You know, like any venture-backed company, our investors at some point are going to expect a return on that investment. And that usually comes in the form of an acquisition or an IPO. I guess in the case of venture firms, it might just be they're bought out at a later round of financing, which is also possible. We try not to think about that much day to day. Obviously, at some point, we want our investors to have a return, and we realize that that's our responsibility to them. But we just try to stay focused on building a great business, and we're kind of in it for the long haul. You know, I want to build a company that survives 100 years, and the exit isn't something we really think about much day to day. We want it to happen eventually, but we're just really focused on creating a great experience for our customers and building a long-lasting company.
Well, the siren song is strong, and it's good that you don't think about it on a day-to-day basis, but it's hard not to, but that's good.
But I think it depends on what the entrepreneur's motivation is. This is a labor of love for me, and it's something that I started for personal reasons, and I'm motivated to do it every day for personal reasons as well. And I think that's just kind of manifests itself naturally in the decisions we make here. I recognize that our investors expect a big exit one day and hope to give that to them. But it's just not something that we stay focused on.
Mm. Jared, I want to ask you a question that was popping up for me earlier, is what would incentivize medical doctors to become your medical detectives? Is it the cash? Is it something else?
You know, we thought a lot about incentives when we were building the site, and it's something we continue to think about quite a bit, because we've essentially built this kind of community, or two-sided community, where we have patients on one side and medical detectives on the other. For a patient, the motivation is quite clear. They just want to get better. They want to have a diagnosis or solution that returns them to health. On the medical detective side, it's more nuanced because they're not in the same kind of pain as our patients are. So we have to motivate them in other ways. And we break it down into two general categories of incentives for them. There's intrinsic and extrinsic. There's been lots of behavioral science research on the types of rewards that that are most motivating for people when it comes to different types of tasks. And for tasks like what our medical detectives are doing, most of the research shows that intrinsic rewards tend to be more powerful than extrinsic. So we built the site mostly around intrinsic rewards. In our case, it's things like intellectual curiosity or the intellectual challenge of solving tough cases. It's competition with peers. So we have a leaderboard where we rank our top-performing medical detectives, and climbing to the top of that leaderboard is a big motivator for them. There's a learning aspect, so medical detectives can learn from each other, and that's a big motivator for them as well, especially our the ones in medical school. Med students are actually a very large group of our active medical detectives. Also, there's simply the humanitarian aspect. There's something very fulfilling about helping save people's lives, and we certainly emphasize that, you know, that reward as well.
Yeah.
So those are all the intrinsic things, and I think, frankly, those are the main motivators for detectives. However, we also have an extrinsic motivator, which is our cash compensation system. So, as I mentioned before, when a patient posts their case, they can offer a cash compensation amount that's distributed to the medical detectives who do the best job in their case. And we've seen, you know, compensation offers exceeding $1,000, so that it is real money. But we think that's probably maybe third or fourth or fifth, at least, in terms of the motivators for our detectives, because most of them tell us that the intrinsic rewards are really what keep them coming back.
Yeah. Well, Jared, this is has been a fascinating conversation, and I just have one final question I can't let you go without asking. Once your sister got her diagnosis, it took months. Once you came up with a prediction model for your business, for CrowdMed, did you enter her symptoms in just to see how long it would take to get a diagnosis?
It's a great question. And, of course, that was the first case that we tested. I probably should have mentioned that already. we built the prototype, and we wanted to see if it could solve tough cases. And, of course, I'm thinking, well, the most difficult medical case that I know is my sister's. So what we did is something very bold, where even though her case had taken all these years and all these doctors to solve, we wanted to make that our first test case. And I was pretty sure it wouldn't work. I was pretty sure that, you know, as well-built as we felt the system was, I was pretty sure it would fail on a case as tough as hers.
Well, and also the personal connection, you know?
Yeah, well, that was also, since it was, you know, my big motivator in the first place, personally, I wanted to see if it could solve that case. So it wasn't all science. It was also, personal. And we put her case up, and much to our surprise, our crowd came up with the correct diagnosis for her in just a few weeks. The same diagnosis that had taken the medical system several years. And that's actually what gave me the courage to turn this into a real business and start raising capital, and I'd say what led to where the company is today.
And Jared, the diagnosis resulted in a very simple hormone patch, which effectively eliminated all of her symptoms in less than 1 month. So that's pretty impressive.
That's right. You know, in her case, and we actually see this quite often, where there can be just one insight, just one insight that may seem very small, but can make the world of difference to a patient. And in her case, that insight was to go on a hormone replacement therapy. So it was very inexpensive, a very straightforward treatment. And within just a few weeks of beginning this treatment, she was back to health, which felt miraculous to her and to our family. So it just goes to show how, just getting that correct insight can just be the difference in life and death or living, you know, having a life worth living or not. And, you know, we exist to bring that insight to our patients.
And if you weren't already her favorite brother, I have a feeling you are now.
She's very proud, and it has definitely strengthened our relationship.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I wanted to ask you, are there investment opportunities for individuals for the next round?
You know, we raised our seed round, which was a $2.4 million round. It was mostly venture capital firms, We did have a handful of individual investors. That round is closed. So our next round will be a Series A. And usually Series A only includes institutional investors.
Right.
So the long answer to your question is unfortunately, the answer is probably no.
Well, if anything changes, give us a call here at Cool Science Radio. I'd like to talk to you about it.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm flattered by the idea, and I will let you know if that changes. At this point, it's just really all about execution for us.
Right.
And just, you know, turning it into a successful business. But, you know, we're well on the way.
Well, Jared, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with all your endeavors.
Excellent. Thank you, Jen. You guys have some great questions. So it was a pleasure to do the interview.
Bye-bye.
Again, that was Jared Heyman. He's the CEO of CrowdMed. That's a fascinating business, and what they're doing, their business model is quite something.
We're going to keep our eye on that company and see what happens.
Yeah, that's right. This is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back with the journalist Lynn Scher and the author. She's written a book about the first woman in space, Sally Ride. Stay with us.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves contemporary American cuisine with a summer menu including produce from their urban garden, open nightly at 5:30 p.m. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. In 1983, Sally Ride became the first woman in space. She was in many ways a perfect candidate to break into the male-dominated world at NASA. She was athletic, bright. She'd been a semi-pro tennis player before entering a graduate physics program at Stanford as the only woman. She was bold, likable. She was a pioneer. She also held a deep secret until her death of pancreatic cancer in 2012. Our next guest, Lynn Scher, was a reporter in the 80s covering the space program at the time that Sally Ride was entering the space program, and the two became fast friends. Now, in the memory of Sally Ride, Scher has written a book called Sally Ride, the First Woman in Space. Lynn Scher, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, I'm delighted to be with you, and I just need to make one little addition. She was America's first woman in space.
She was.
There were, of course, two Russian women who beat her to it, but she was our first, and with the transparency and the excitement of the U.S. space program, that's the impact she had on the world.
Yeah, just incredible. Just incredible. First things first, she was very talented. She, along with 8,000 other people, answered an advertisement in the Stanford student newspaper seeking applicants for the space program, and she was chosen to join NASA in 1978. She had to be pretty good.
She was excellent. And, you know, all the candidates were excellent, as a matter of fact. And when Sally saw that article and applied right away, she read the qualifications for this new category of astronaut called mission specialist. And this, of course, was 1977. We were starting up the new space shuttle program. And NASA was actually reaching out to women and minorities for the very first time. The men who had gone to the moon were all recruited under programs that essentially were looking for test pilots and jet fighter pilots and military men. And now they said, wait a minute, we not only need pilots, we need scientists to do experiments in space. We can have larger crews in the shuttle. And Sally understood this was her golden ticket to the future and applied immediately. And as you say, Well, as you say, more than 8,000 people applied, and she was selected. Extraordinary woman.
Those test pilots, they were a tough group, and they had an exclusive little club. What was their reaction?
Some of the men who had flown on the Mercury and Gemini and Apollo flights were a little uncomfortable. They believed that the standards were being lowered by letting women in and by letting minorities in. Over time, they all realized how wrong they were, and NASA really, once they came around to figuring out that women could do the job perfectly well and in some cases better than some of their male counterparts, then there really was no discrimination within NASA at that point.
Well, we've come a long way since 1978. I mean, I was reading a couple of questions that reporters asked her after she was brought in. One of those questions was, "Does space affect your reproductive organs?" And another question.
Well, you know, the truth is, when before humans went into space at all, back in the 1950s, the late 50s, there was concern that weightlessness would do very weird things to our bodies. John Glenn always talked about the fact that before he flew, of course, the first American in orbit, they didn't know if his legs would go all wobbly. They were afraid that eyeballs would get all squishy and that astronauts would not be able to see. These were some of the great unknowns. I think it's probably reasonable to wonder about all sorts of organs, but the questions Sally was asked were absolutely outrageous. You pick that one.
Oh, no, the other one I was going to pick was somebody asked her, when she encounters problems, does she cry?
Do you weep, is what he said. And, you know, this was a reporter from Time magazine. I was, of course, sitting in the room. This was the final pre-flight press conference for Sally's first flight, and there was an audible gasp in the room. It was just so outrageous. But you know what? Here's another reason why she was exactly the right person chosen. Some of us might have sort of clawed the guy's eyes out and said, "What are you talking about?" Sally laughed, slightly rolled her eyes, turns to Rick Hauck, the pilot of her shuttle mission, sitting next to her, and says, smiling, "Why doesn't anyone ever ask Rick these questions?" And totally diffused it. You know, she was able to get over it, and what a great representative she was for all of us.
That's so funny. I just have to relate. The other day, I think it was on The Daily Show, someone accused Hillary Clinton of getting emotional, and he went through this montage of all these male politicians actually weeping on camera.
I know. I mean, it wasn't, by the way, it wasn't just the press. Johnny Carson joked on The Tonight Show, America's favorite late-night comedian, that the reason the shuttle, there had been a slight postponement, the reason the shuttle was delayed was that Sally Ride could then get a purse to match her shoes.
This is the level
of conversation.
Oh, that's good. So, you know, you also were a journalist at that time, and while you... I would imagine that the presence of women in journalism was a little better than the presence of women in the space program at that point. But you also were in a man's world to some degree. But no doubt you looked at these different women in science and how much they were pioneers for what we're really so much promoting today is women in science and girls in STEM education and that sort of thing. And so talk a little bit about, if you would, about that evolution of women in science and what you saw it do as a journalist.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think, by the way, the fact that I was also working on what had been a man's world, I think that's why Sally and I bonded so quickly. We really had a great friendship. And one of the things I really loved about her was she acknowledged immediately that she was only at NASA because of the women's movement. That if there hadn't been social pressure on the space agency, there would never have been female astronauts, which I think is true. But the evolution was amazing to see, certainly in my business, but in women in science, you know, Sally, when she left NASA and started her own company, Sally Ride Science, would tell people that she didn't want little girls to think that the image of a scientist was a geeky guy with a slide protector in his pocket. A pocket protector and a slide rule in his pocket. And this is the image that they would draw when you ask them to draw a scientist. So she she was trying to make that evolution happen as well by focusing on middle school girls. But, you know, I think one of the keys to making the change was her flight. Right before she flew, I had my one-on-one interview with her, and I said to her, Sally, do you feel under any pressure as the first American woman in space? And she said, I do feel pressure not to mess up. And I think what she meant was not to mess up, not only for the crew and the mission, after all, it's a team operation, not only for NASA and the future of human spaceflight, but for women. She knew that if she messed up, that all women would be blamed and that no female astronaut would be seen as being ready to do the job. But if she did well, then that would open the door for the rest of them. And indeed, that's exactly what happened because she performed beautifully.
Mm. And Sally Ride was really the antithesis of the nerdy scientist with the pocket protector and the slide rule, because she was this athletic, vibrant gal. She, I understand she played, I mean, you say she tried out as to play, be a pro tennis player, and I don't know exactly how successful she was, but it wasn't all about science for her. She was well-rounded.
That's exactly right. And by the way, her undergraduate degree at Stanford was a double major in physics and English. She was a Shakespearean. You know,
she had it going on.
A reason to truly hate her. She really, she was very well-rounded, and she deeply wanted little girls, particularly, to feel the joy of science that she felt, the miracle of science, the magic of science, the beauty of science. This is something she was really building up to. She wanted to awaken all those young female minds to the wonder of science that had captivated her. And she wanted to teach them, if you're a girl, you can do anything. And by the way, this country really needs scientists and mathematicians and engineers to solve our problems for the future.
Mm. And first,
you know what, the line she repeated over and over, and for your program, this is perfect, was, we need to make science cool.
Mm. Yeah. There we go.
Well, first and foremost, for everything that she was a physicist. And she liked the fact that only 90-some naturally occurring elements would comprise everything from a grain of sand to the furthest star. And physics kind of means being a precise, it's a precise world. It's not arbitrary. And that's who she was. I would also mention that she wasn't just trained and she went up in one of the shuttles. She actually was CAPCOM, the capsule communicator, for the second and the third flight. And she also was very involved in developing the space shuttle's robot arm, which of course was absolutely key in making many of the experiments work.
And you know what's interesting about that? You talk about the fact that she was so well-rounded. I believe, and NASA also believed, that one of the reasons Sally was so expert at working that remote manipulator arm, that giant crane that lifted satellites around in space, is because of her tennis experience. She had terrific hand-eye coordination. And that in concert with her ability to play on a team in tennis made her a wonderful crew member on any flight. And I think this is a great lesson, that you don't have to just be expert in one thing. You really need to have a lot of different things going on in your life to be good at any one thing.
Right.
Wanted to get into the secret part of Sally Ride's life, and I'm wondering if it was part of her desire to be a representative for all women or a pioneer that she kept in a time where sexual orientation was not so open and free, but she kept her sexual preference a secret until her death, really. Even you as a good friend didn't know about it.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. Sally had male friends, boyfriends and girlfriends for her life, and I talk about all this for the first time in the book. And she was married to a man, to another astronaut, while she was at NASA. And when she left, she was in a 27-year relationship with another woman, Tam O'Shaughnessy. And I believe that to a great extent, Sally was protecting NASA and protecting the astronaut office. I think she was concerned about what would think, NASA not being the most progressive socially of all agencies, certainly back then. And I also think she just was a very private person. She had her causes she stood up for. She cared about women. She cared about women in sports. She cared about women in science. She cared about protecting the Earth. These were the things she wanted to be known for. She was a very private, shy person. And I do believe if she had spoken out about her relationship with Tam, that would have sort of taken all the privacy away from her that she had left. And this was her choice.
Mm. Well, that's a pretty complete answer. So thank you for that. And you decided to include it in the book, sort of, you say, chronologically. So you went back and you talked to all these people that she had relationships with throughout her life. She was a very well-loved individual by men and women alike, by everyone it sounds like she came into contact with.
She was very well loved. She was a sunny, optimistic individual. And, you know, what's really interesting, she also taught at the University of California, San Diego, for many years. She taught physics. She taught space science. She also taught a course called Physics for Poets, so that people who were like English and French majors could learn about science. And one of the physics students whom she advised said a wonderful thing to me. He went on to become a chief engineer at NASA. And he said, you know, Sally really loved science above everything. Hmm. He said she was, at root, she was a scientist who took a detour through space. And I think
great.
That's a wonderful description of her, don't you?
Mm, yes, absolutely.
I always play a game with people, and I say, if I woke you up in the middle of the night, tell me the thing you would be. That is, you know, would you be a radio announcer? Would you be woman? Would you be somebody who lives in Ute? Whatever. And everyone I talked to said that if you woke Sally up in the middle of the night, the answer would have been either scientist or physicist.
Exactly.
This is who she saw herself as at root. And space was a great adventure, and she loved it. Never occurred to her before she saw that article in the Stanford Daily to apply. But once she did it, she loved it, and yet she went back to her science roots, after all. She really wanted kids to feel and see the wonder.
Well, I'm a science and technology nut, and I got my start with the space program with the test pilots, you know, reading popular science and popular mechanics back before the Mercury program started. And like many other guys and girls, you know, I wanted to be an astronaut. And I ended up having a career in technology. And I remember exactly where I was on January 29th, 86, when the Challenger exploded. And, I mean, I just never forget that day. And there was a lot going on in the investigation of that. And the thing that really struck me was that according to Roger Beaujolais, who is the engineer who warned of the technical problems that led to the Challenger disaster, Sally was the only public figure to really show support for him when he went public with his pre-disaster warnings. And Morton Thiokol, all the employees had shunned him. Morton Thiokol, of course, is a Utah-based company. And Sally Wright actually hugged him publicly to show her support for his efforts. And I just really applaud that.
Well, it's true. And this, unfortunately, that meeting was not open to the press. So the only record we have of that hug, and she also gave a hug after Alan MacDonald gave his testimony, another Morton Thiokol person. And I've spoken to Alan MacDonald about this. Roger Beaujolais, of course, has died. But there were no reporters in the room. It is very uncharacteristic of Sally to have given anyone a hug. I tell you that, having known her for 30 years. And yet, I have no doubt that this happened. I only wish I had been there to see it myself. It didn't get any publicity until Beaujolais talked about it, and then Alan MacDonald now has talked about it also. But Sally was a key player in uncovering not only that it was the failure of the O-rings, but that it was a failure of management. And that management, certainly the Marshall Space Flight Center and at Thiokol, that there were just some really bad decisions made that had nothing to do with the way NASA usually makes decisions. This was a very brave move for a woman who at the time was still an active shuttle astronaut. Very tough for her, don't you think?
Absolutely. And not only was she named to the President's Council to investigate the Challenger, but she was, I think, the only astronaut at NASA that was named to both. She was also named to the panel that investigated the Columbia disaster.
That's right. And also played a key role there, making key decisions, once again, focusing on the fact that it was essentially a flawed management decision. Yes, the hardware, the technology got broken, but that could be fixed, but it was management. And she had that very, very famous line after seeing some of the evidence, which was, "I'm hearing something of an echo here." And she meant an echo back to the Challenger days. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Sally used to once was the bright new face of NASA, and she ultimately became its conscience. She wanted NASA to be better all the time and worked very hard to make it that way long after she was gone from there.
Lynn, I don't know if you remember this or not, but Gus Grissom, who, of course, was the astronaut that was in the Mercury program initially, he said once that it's disconcerting to be sitting on top of this candle, you know, sitting on top of the rocket,
right,
knowing that there are 10,000 contractors that were selected based on lowest price and quickest delivery. I mean,
right, the lowest bidders. Yeah,
that is disconcerting. And of course, Gus Grissom had a tragic.
It is. I do remember that line from Grissom. And don't forget, the whole space shuttle system was a compromised program. It was after we had left the moon. It was after Skylab. It was after the Apollo-Soyuz test project. And the shuttle program was a compromise to cut costs, to do something in space without a specific goal. And I think that on top of that, they developed the most complicated space vehicle that was ever, ever designed. The shuttle was a miracle. And yet today, the cell phone that you and I hold in our hands, by many degrees, is way more complicated than even the space shuttle. The whole thing is just extraordinary.
Yeah, there was a core board in the lunar landing module that had 32 kbytes of memory, and the average cheap $2.99 calculator has more memory than the entire lunar landing module.
They were working under some interesting circumstances, shall we say. Yeah. But you know what's so interesting? We always look at Apollo 13 as the model of ingenuity when they figured out how to get the craft back, and it really was brilliant. But every single thing they did, there was some element of that. These astronauts are so clever, they got in space. And Sally Ride, on her two flights, fixed a couple of little things, and she did it on the ground also, because they all knew how to use their minds.
Absolutely.
This is one of the great things about these astronauts. They were so talented, not only at flying or working an experiment, but at just figuring out how to make something work.
Lynn, we want to thank you so much. We could talk to you all morning. A fascinating book, Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. Lynn, thanks so much for being on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Lynn.
I just want to mention quickly that Sally also wrote or co-wrote 7 books on space aimed at children with the goal of encouraging children to study science. Very cool.
And this is Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back.
Nexus IT is proud to support Cool Science Radio and KPCW. Nexus IT provides complete cloud computing solutions to streamline and simplify your business, IT processes, and logistics. 435-487-9099. NexusITC.net.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, parkcitynursery.com. Brett Stimson, mortgage assistant for home purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. We want to thank our guests today, Jared Heyman, CrowdMed CEO, and also Lynn Scher, the author of the book, Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. Both fascinating. And I want to thank our underwriter, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus ITC. And also want to remind you to tune in tomorrow. It's the first week without Fun Friday as a show because they had their grand finale last week, but we will be celebrating KPCW Day. Tomorrow is the Back Alley Bash, tomorrow evening from 5 to 9 on the Town Lift Plaza, and we'll be talking about that. We're going to save our cool science story about the woman who invented Kevlar for next week.
Yeah.
She just died.
Another woman science pioneer.
That's right. You're listening to KPCW Park City.